Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. The 2019 election has been framed by many as the town's election. Both of the main parties regard winning the votes of people living in so-called left-behind towns in the Midlands and the North as crucial to winning the election. Why are these towns so important to the election, and what are the parties offering them to win them over? To explore these and other election-related issues, my guests today are Will Tanner, Director of Onward, a right-leaning think tank, and Rachel Lawrence, Director of Programmes at Place at the New Economics Foundation, a left-leaning think tank. Welcome to you both. So let's start with this, your thoughts really on the framing of the election in terms of it's all about towns and them being critical to the 2019 election. I mean, why is that? Rachel, why is the framing so important?
So I think what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years since the Brexit vote, which I really think is true across the political spectrum from left to right, is a recognition that the way the economy has been working, growing at certain times, not growing at certain times, hasn't worked equally well for people across different parts of the UK. Some of that is about regional disparities, north to south, but a lot of that is about the differences between how economies work in cities and how they've come to work in towns. And that's not by accident. That's to do with a bunch of different economic factors. Some of those are international, global. You know, as our economies become more globalised, more centred in the UK around, kind of driven by a financialised services sector, which tends to, you know, grow in cities, particularly in the southeast. So that's one factor that's driven that. But there's also been a number of policies which are to do with things like the idea that agglomerating businesses in cities and letting towns fulfil a kind of secondary function in the economy as a kind of fairly deliberate policy, particularly over the sort of 90s and 2000s, has undoubtedly contributed to the fact that what you now see is basically a model where you have economic activity happening in city centres. That's where the office blocks are, that's where the jobs are, and increasingly the towns become the sort of dormitory suburbs, which some would argue has an unintended outcome of bleeding their local economies dry. And I think that's been manifest to people living in towns for a long time, but it really, I think that the divisions, and Ness done some research on this, that then started to become more visible through the referendum in 2016 and the election in 2017, between how this really makes the lived experience of the economy different depending on whether you live in a town or a city. That's what's now starting to play out in national politics.
Okay, well, what would you add into that? And I suppose take on from the economic perspective, throw in the political perspective, because some of these are reasonably marginal, or could be marginal seats depending upon.
Yes, I mean, I think I would agree with a lot of what Rachel just said, but I would just throw in some kind of political data on top of the kind of economic trends that she's talking about, in the sense that I think in the last few years, and potentially over a much longer period, we've seen quite a significant shift in the way in which people's attitudes towards what you might call kind of liberal policies and the kind of liberal market economy have changed quite drastically. So we did some research at the beginning of this election which showed that increasingly people are kind of moving away from what you might call the politics of freedom, independence, autonomy, and increasingly desire something a bit like the politics of belonging is what we call it. So focused on community, a sense of place, a much greater sense of kind of reciprocity with kind of fellow people. And so if you look at statistics, if you ask people whether or not they want a society based on giving people more freedom or giving them people more security, by 2-1, they want a society that favours security over freedom. If you look at specific factors in the kind of the economy, they say that roughly 71% of people think that the growth of universities has been a bad thing for society. 66% of people think the growth of cities has been a bad thing for the UK. So across a kind of range of different factors, you're seeing people looking for a slightly different type of change to the one I think that's been offered by politicians of all parties over recent decades. And that's particularly concentrated in a load of seats in the North and the Midlands, especially. We call them kind of rugby league towns because they're typically the towns that were founding members of the rugby league, places like Workington, Wigan, Warrington, Castleford, Dewsbury, those type of places. But it's a broad trend which actually is true of lots of different places in the kind of north and Midlands of England. And those are the types of seats where I think you're likely to see the biggest swings in the upcoming election.
So I suppose you represent slightly different parts of the political spectrum. What's striking in reading and listening to Labour politicians and Conservative politicians, at least when they're laying out the problems, there is an enormous amount of similarity.
I think it's right. I think the analysis of the problem is, in certain senses, less politicised. What becomes then a question of ideological choices of what you do about it, really. That's where perhaps you then see different solutions being put forward. Although even then, I would suggest there's something really interesting happening, I think. And so I spend a lot of my time in places doing, I work a lot with local authorities, a lot with community-led development, economic development groups and that kind of thing. And as soon as you get outside the Westminster bubble, as soon as you get outside of London, and particularly as soon as you get outside the bigger cities, because to a certain extent, Sheffield and Manchester, you will still get the same kind of dynamics. The way that we have become accustomed to thinking about how ideas and approaches and things that matter to people, how those are split across party lines, completely shifts. So the kinds of councils who are picking up some of the work that NEF has long pioneered around kind of community control and bottom up and, going away from a growth-focused, growth-focused narrative around economy towards a well-being focus, for example. Some of the councils that are kind of biggest and boldest on that are Tory councils, even ones that are now kind of increasingly controlled by the Brexit Party. And I think it comes back to this sense of ultimately, and this is not a political thing, this is somehow underpins all of that, this sense, I think it's absolutely right, of not belonging, not feeling like the economy and the way that society's developed has picked people up with it. Now, of course, what I would say and what NEF would say is a critique of, the idea that has been promoted for a long time that you get growth, as long as you sort the growth out, you'll get trickle down. Growth is a proxy for all the other good stuff. I think what's kind of clear is that it hasn't been a proxy for the good stuff. That doesn't mean you don't need some growth in some instances to get the jobs and the money, but you can't do the growth and hope that everybody gets the benefits of it. There's other stuff you have to do. And so a lot of what I end up doing is talking about things like supply chains and making sure that smaller businesses are connected into the larger business opportunities. Now, a lot of this stuff is not left or right wing. This is about good practice economic development. And I think what's really interesting is that actually we did some research after the election results in 2017 that showed a big swing, that the swing towards Labour was mainly in cities and the swing towards Conservative votes was mainly in towns, which is interesting. But when you unpick what sits beneath that, really, I'm not necessarily sure it's really explained by kind of a traditional understanding of what the right and the left offer politically. It's something much more granular than that. And I think that's a challenge for both parts of the spectrum, for Labour and for Conservatives, is not to take for granted what one assumes people's natural sense of common sense is, either around economics and what is good economic logic and what is good economic practice, or, as you say, Will, around identity and belonging and what that means. So I think for all of us, it's wise to not make assumptions that we know where we're at just because we know where historically we've sat on the spectrum.
Well, what's your perspective on the similarity, or are there differences in, at least in on the problem identification exposition side?
I think there are a huge amount of similarities in both the problem and the solution, actually. And I actually spend lots of my time, I mean, we are right of centre, but I spend lots of my time reminding people of actually quite strong small-c conservative traditions around community and belonging and place, which actually, if you look historically through kind of centre-right thinking over the ages, has been one of the, if not the most important philosophical trend at the heart of conservatism. It's about gradualism and giving people a much greater sense of community. And if you read people like Robert Nisbet, or if you read some kind of Tory politicians like Ian MacLeod in the kind of latter half of the 20th century, that is the type of things that they're talking about. It just so happens that the past 30 years of kind of centre-right policy have been dominated by a tradition that's much more liberal than conservative. And so lots of the kind of problem identification and policy solutions have tended towards a much more market-centric view of the world, and something that's probably a lot more individualistic than communitarian. And actually a lot of what we do is actually trying to reclaim some of that intellectual tradition on the centre right, because I think it is not only right in principle but actually increasingly timely for the political debate that we're having post Brexit, at a time when, as we say, some of the kind of towns or communities outside big cities are coming quite sharply into focus in terms of the disadvantage and lack of opportunities that's there for many people. And when those voters are becoming much more politically important, this agenda becomes kind of front and centre. And so I kind of dispute the idea that there's a left-right spectrum on lots of this stuff, and would actually argue that that there's in some ways quite a good kind of common ground debate to be had between people of different traditions.
I'm reminded by, it's in a different context, but I remember an American mayor saying in the US there are three political parties. You get the Democrats, you get the Republicans, and you get the mayors. And what he meant was, I mean, as you know, is actually when you get onto the ground, when stuff needs to be done, ideology in some respects, not in all respects, but in some respects, falls away, and the practicality of and the needs to get things done. And I think there is definitely similarity to that. As the representative of Centre for Cities, you know, at the table, I'd be interested in your thoughts about, you know, where this sort of idea or, you know, a manifestation of cities as bad things, I hear that increasingly, and where that's come from and how you think about that. But also, in a sense, I, you know, I definitely duty bound to say, you know, many of the issues that we see in our towns are also present in some of our big, very bigger urban areas. And I know for a minute you're not suggesting, you're suggesting that it's one of terminology and definition. But more generally, kind of step back, economics and politics together, you know, where does that leave us in relation to our cities, which we know, even places like Greater Manchester or Greater Birmingham, Sheffield, you know, many of them are underperforming, economically at least. They should be doing much better than they actually are. So I'm just curious, but where's that come from? I mean, what's your analysis on that?
I think there's two things that belong in that question. They're both address slightly different points. So there's the first thing, so working backwards. So this question of, you know, cities that are not performing well. I spend a lot of time, I was in Great Yarmouth yesterday, literally having this conversation. And when you go to places like that, those are the places that say, well, why don't we get a piece of the pie? You know, why is it all about the cities? But really there are different ways of understanding what is a local economy. Mm. And something that I think we don't spend enough time thinking about, any of us, is what those different ways are and how they sit in tension to one another. So if you are a local politician, whatever your party is, if you're a community member trying to make your own community better, when you think local economy, you think about the lived experience of the local economy, right? Where your job is, where healthcare is, how long it takes you to get to your job, how far it is from your childcare pickup spot to where the shops are, and is your kid going to have a tantrum on the way? All of these things intersect, and it's the intersection between those things that makes up your lived experience of the local economy and whether you feel like your economy is good or not good. Now, the national understanding of what is the local economy, you know, Treasury industrial strategy type understanding is, what is that area's contribution to the national pot? What is that area's GVA? What proportion of GDP does that area contribute? And so when we think about, you know, city growth deals, industrial strategy now talking about the regional imbalance, what you're talking about is the amount of economic activity that is happening in a geographic space as a proportion of the total. That doesn't necessarily correspond to what people's lived experience of the economy is. And that brings to the second point. You're absolutely right. Many of the problems that we're describing about how the economy as we know it doesn't pick up all of the people, it doesn't equitably distribute the wealth, is just as true in cities as in towns. And the example I like to use, before I worked at F, my job was working on child poverty strategies with local authorities. London, with, you know, that 23% or thereabouts of GDP in the UK comes from London, and the next big city is I think Manchester with 13. But 23%, but the highest child and adult poverty you know, levels, it's got the highest proportion of graduate women who don't work, you know, all of these. Do we therefore say it's a good economy? I would suggest not. But it's harder to see that in a city than it is in a town. So I would say that the problems we're talking about how the economy doesn't work for many communities are just as much a problem in a city. But it's easier to look at Wigan and say, yeah, this whole town has lost out, than it is to look at London and say, London's not doing very well. Because someone will always say, what are you talking about? London's doing fine. But yeah, I get that Wigan's not doing well. So I think it's partly about that.
No, Well, your thoughts, I mean, is there a, does the sort of strand of conservatism, small C, does it, how does it think and treat cities? I mean, it, you know, through history there's, because the left has got a similar sort of ambivalence and uncertainty about the urban, particularly the bigger urban, and certainly, you know, there is a strand of conservatism that is much more small, village orientated, you know, all of that. But, I mean...
Well, I think the great tension in this debate is the fact that cities are, and will continue to be, and probably will increasingly be, the drivers of economic growth in an increasingly agglomerated global economy. And there is nothing that any political party in the UK can do about that. They might reprioritise some policies, they might kind of spend money in a slightly different place, but actually the reality is cities are intrinsic to our model of growth. They are obviously home to many millions of people, and they are very important parts of our economy, and we are going to need to find ways to broker that relationship, I think, between cities and the places around them in order to ensure that that resentment doesn't build up, and the kind of cities or especially London versus the rest narrative, which has started to seep quite deeply into our political consciousness, doesn't end up being the defining kind of feature of the next 5-10 years of economic growth. But I think there are potentially ways around that, and there are ways that are kind of instinctively kind of centre-right conservative ways around that. But it is about, for example, investing in infrastructure and especially transport infrastructure. It's really striking the extent to which Britain's regional cities, not including London, lag behind their European counterparts. Our kind of second, third, fourth cities are far less productive, far lower levels of growth than the equivalents in Germany or France, as I know the Centre for Cities has said many times. Yeah. And so there is clearly a case for investing in those places, but I would argue that we probably need to do so in a way that isn't exclusively for them and actually is about connecting them to places around them and towns in their orbit in order to share some of the proceeds of growth. And also, at the same time, put in some of the building blocks of self-sufficient growth in those towns as well, because I think a lot of the time the cities versus towns debate is often characterised by the fact that there is money going into cities and lots of towns just don't feel there is money going into towns. So I think it's more of just about the distribution of that investment and trying to build some of those links which in this global kind of agglomerated economy actually do drive some activity outside cities as well, so R&D and business parks and things that help.
So I really agree with all of that. I think what the kind of the next step on from that sort of logical query, and that maybe this is where we get into that there's different approaches, you know, although I think broadly speaking it's not necessarily the left and right spectrum, but I think yes, investment clearly needs to go into places that it hasn't gone into. You know, the difference between, interestingly, what's happened in the UK versus, say, France and Germany, one of the differences is a vastly more interventionist state in the economy. It's much more of a planned economy. And I think it's interesting that, you know, it's under the Conservatives now that we've had the first discussions of an industrial strategy after years of that just not being a thing that anybody would talk about, let alone the Conservatives. So again, I think it's a good thing that we start to think about that national level. I think all the parties are now thinking about that. But I think, you know, across the spectrum, there's a sense that, you know, you do need a certain level of intervention at the very least into the infrastructure and the planning and to redress the kind of path dependency that we've built up over 40 odd years. You know, we're now in a situation where if you're saying to a kind of hard-nosed financial investor, do you want to invest in this thing that's going to be in London or in, you know, in Canterbury, or do you want to invest in it in Wigan? If you invest in Canterbury, you're going to get a return on investment that looks like this. If you invest in Wigan, you're going to have to wait another 20 years. It's not going to happen. So you can't just let the market do its thing. Letting the market do its thing reinforces the current thing that we have, which brings me to what we really need to be talking about is beyond just investment. So beyond, it's great to have funds. It's great to have, you know, a strong towns fund announced. And, you know, actually Labour is also announcing various funds, the Just Transition funds. All of the parties are thinking about pots of money. That's a good thing, I think. But that doesn't, what I'm really interested in is how do you pick apart the structural stuff that sits underneath that in the economy. Infrastructure is one of the things, transport infrastructure is one of the things, but it's the levels of wealth that have accumulated in that place. It's the kind of the long-term, the way that institutions work or don't work, the quality of education providers, how well they collect into the local job market. it's so many things, you know, it's the hollowing out of a lot of the civic institutions. There was a great article recently by Aditya Chakrabarty, which I thought was spot on, right on the money, about the fact that, you know, when you don't have your libraries and you don't have your community centres and you don't have your pubs anymore and you don't really have that many people meeting in a church or a faith organisation, broadly speaking, as it, compared to years ago, that stuff matters. And that stuff matters for the economy. It matters for how thriving that place is. It can't be seen as, oh, that's the social policy stuff over here and then the big boys play with the economy over here. You've got to start seeing it as a more holistic system and understand how the community and civil society infrastructure is core to that engine of economy. And that's where I think all parties can get around the table, but you know, there are differences of opinion, I suppose, in how active should the state be, how much should it be bottom up, top down, you know.
And actually, I don't disagree with a huge amount of that, but I guess the question is, how do you affect that change? And I guess where we would differ is probably the extent to which the state should be the driver of some of that kind of replenishment of civic institutions or the anchor of some of that social or economic activity in those local places, or whether or not there are ways of fostering that apart from the state and potentially apart from the market as well. And we don't talk enough, I think, about kind of community and civic standalone institutions and organisations. So, I mean, I don't disagree at all that a big part of bringing up some of these places and restoring some of that sense of belonging and community must come very locally, and it must come with the kind of restoration of some of those institutions which gave life and substance to the social fabric in those places. But it, I just question whether or not the state, especially the central state, is necessarily the driver of that change.
I think that's exactly the right question to be asking. I think when we talk about the state, it is right to ask, are we talking about the central, are we talking about the local, and what do we mean? And not, on the one hand, not to discount state as always being one thing and always bad. And actually, on the left, there is that, you know, you have this funny spectrum if you have the sort of, you know, the communitarian kind of more anarchist left versus the kind of statist interventionist left. And that plays out very sharply at the kind of in the work that I do around community-led economic development. You know, there's a lot of kind of feeling that the state is the local state might be the kiss of death to this scheme, and it's much more energy if it's being led by the community. And oftentimes I see situations in which I'd absolutely agree about that. I don't think the answer that gives you is necessarily, oh, this shouldn't be the local authority running it. It might be the local authority should be running it differently. It might be the local authority is in some instances a good holder of funds, but that the delivery shouldn't be done. You know, there's so many different permutations of it. And likewise between central and local, you know, I think, you know, NEF is very strongly in favour of decentralisation. Our analysis of how devolution has gone so far is critical in some parts, but in terms of the mechanisms and what that's been around. But the principle of the idea that, you know, places understand how the economy works for that place and they understand what the solutions need to be stands. Also the principle that the institutions that make decisions about how funding should be spent and who invest in things should have a democratic mandate. And so there, the one answer that I said, well, the thing that has a democratic mandate and is local is your local council. Or other people say, yeah, but they don't work in a very democratic way, it should be something else. Mm. For me, the principle that the institution has a democratic mandate is key. And that's where I might be sometimes wary of, say, a private sector institution running something, although I think they have absolutely got a place to play. But of course, they're not, you know, they're not democratic institutions and they shouldn't have to be.
So just if we take a step back for a second, because I think notwithstanding points of difference at the margin, I think you're still, you know, right there in terms of which, and most nearly everything of what you said, you know, I would also agree with the comment, yeah, I suppose, you know, from a city perspective. Just take a step back for a second, though, and say, so, you know, we're 2 weeks out from an election. Where are the parties on the sorts of issues that you've just been talking about? I mean, somewhat critical perspective would be that they're nowhere really. I mean, they're broad statements about, you know, lots more money to be spent, and we can, you know, some Labour spending more than the Conservatives on different things. But in terms of some of the other issues that we've talked about, doesn't seem to be addressing some of the things that you've just talked about, the pair of you. Well, what's your take on, you know, give us your sense as to where the political parties are in this election in relation to the agenda that the pair of you are beginning to outline.
Well, I think, I mean, I can speak much more clearly to the Conservatives than I can to the Labour Party, but we've been quite pleased with the level to which Boris Johnson's Downing Street has listened to some of the things that we've said around belonging and place and community. And I think the manifesto rightly talks about putting community at the heart of the government's plans. I mean, the Conservative manifesto is, especially after last time, pared back and playing it safe, arguably. But it does contain £150 million for community ownership, including measures to stop community assets being sold to private sector bidders before the community has had a chance to buy. It contains plans to give local authorities greater chance to bring back railway lines that were cut during the Beeching reforms in the latter half of the last century, and some other measures to try and replenish the high street through tax breaks and lower levels of business rates. So I think Boris Johnson has demonstrated a kind of his intention in terms of the direction of travel towards a more kind of community-focused model, and some of this kind of small C, kind of slightly old-fashioned conservatism that we've been talking about. But there clearly needs to be a lot more ambition from the Conservative Party. And I know there are lots of people on the backbenches in the Conservative Party who are quite deeply of the view that this is the right direction of travel for the Conservative Party, that it's not a kind of aberration, but actually a return to a historic trend and something which could reap quite significant electoral benefits in the future as well. So I think I suspect that the Conservatives will move further along this line. And just one final thing I would add is I thought it was incredibly symbolic for Boris Johnson to stand up at the CBI and say that he was reversing planned cuts to corporation tax, big tax cuts for big businesses, whether you agree with them or not, and spend that money on the NHS because that is quote-unquote a people's priority. Mm. And if you look at the type of issues which come up in the type of towns that we're talking about today, the NHS comes top in every single poll at every single time. So I think that demonstrates to some degree that the Conservatives do get it.
It's interesting, right? We've been discussing, you know, what happens if it goes this way in the election, what happens if it goes that way, what's our work plan, what are we going to be focusing on, what are the things we're going to be grappling with? And the interesting thing that I keep coming back to is, broadly speaking, you know, my interest is the powers that mayors have, the powers that regional authorities have, the amount of investment that's going into the infrastructure and communities, and the kind of structural nature of how structural that is. I think that a lot of the job will be probably ultimately the same. Depending on who wins in terms of mayors and regional governments being very interested in working with an emerging recognition on the right and on the left that, you know, devolution is, you know, probably the thing that we need to invest some time and thinking in. I don't think any of the parties have quite cottoned on to the degree that they're going to have to, how structural this is. I think, yes, the Conservatives and Labour are talking about communities, things being led from below. Labour talks a lot about community wealth building. You know, Conservatives are talking about, as you said, you know, stronger towns fund and these things, which ironically, basically, a lot of this stuff is driving the same sort of stuff, but with slightly different language. I still am not convinced that I still feel like there's a division between the kind of the Westminster bubble on both sides and what I hear from the ground. So what I tend to look at more is what are the right wing and the left wing telling me in places? What are the Tory mayors and the Labour mayors talking about? That's what I find that more helpful in trying to understand which way the parties go. And I think for me, I'm excited about promises that are being made. I mean, not just in Labour, but also from Greens and SNP, sort of on the progressive side, of investment into quite long-term transformational bits of work, so around Just Transition Fund, you know, rewiring our economy over the long run. I do think that that's coming out relatively strongly from Greens and from Labour, and that feels slightly less the language that's being used in the Tories. It's more around towns investing in communities. Broadly speaking, there's a question of, you know, is it just the same, different language to use the same thing? I think, and so I suppose I'm deliberately not wanting to go and, you know, it's not really our business to say these guys are good, these guys are bad.
No.
But in terms of an analysis of what to be looking out for, what I'm looking out for is how structural is this going? You know, I expect all of the parties to be saying we're going to throw some money at this problem. If they don't, then where have they been for the last 3 years? So I'm not surprised that both manifestos talk about funds, talk about putting monies into communities. What I'm interested in is, what is that money going for? Is it just going to go on filling gaps that cuts had already made in the last 10 years? or is it going to go beyond those? Is it going to go on rethinking how we do things like hub and spoke metro systems and HS2 and these big infrastructure projects, or is it going to leave those in place and try and tinker around the edges?
I suppose related to that would be, you know, I'm genuinely curious around not only the quantum of the money that's going in or the time and effort that's going into these places, but then ultimately who gets to make those decisions? Because in a sense, you know, for both parties particularly, there's still an element where, yes, we might spend X pounds more in place Z, but it's still pretty much that we'll be deciding how that money gets spent, or at least it will be tightly ring-fenced, which... You know, again, I think something that certainly brings us together is a sense that, you know, we've for too long have had a kind of very centralized approach to this, you know, to the way that the economy and politics work. And we need to devolve and decentralize both the economy and the politics. But I don't see that in either the main political parties currently, at least not as much as maybe I would have expected. But you tell me I'm missing something.
I think there's something really interesting here, and it kind of comes back to what we were saying before, or what you were saying before about, you know, the American, there's a Republican, yeah, Democrat's mayor. So there's kind of three ways around doing this, right? There's either you say the centre should set the overall vision, and the party, you know, the Tory party says what its overall vision is, and Labour says what it is, and then whoever gets first past the post has a mandate. So either you say, look, the point of the economy overall is going to be growth, but we're going to devolve the powers to local mayors and so on to work out how you deliver that best. And that was basically what, you know, Osborne's devolution was. That was the narrative, you know. We all have agreed that we're going to go for growth, but you guys know how to deliver it better. And then the sort of the flip side of that is, say, a left-wing government coming and saying, no, it's not about growth. It's about, you know, just transition, or it's about this other high-level goal, or it's about, you know, better services. Still a high-level centralised vision saying, but you guys, you the mayors, you know how to deliver that. That's fine. And in a way, although that's two different visions, you know, you could sort of say, well, that's fine. They set it out in their manifesto. Whoever wins, wins. And then it's up to the decentralized administrations to basically do as they're told, but be given much more freedom to implement that better.
Yeah.
Or you flip the whole thing and you say, rather than, for example, saying we're going to have a national industrial strategy, this is what it is, and now we'd like each region to complete a local version of it. You do it the other way around. You say to the mayors, you say, right, you guys tell us what your vision is. What do the people, what do the good people, mm-hmm, of the Northeast think would be a characteristic of a strong local economy for them? Is it about jobs? Is it about a sense of belonging? Is it about high growth, fast growth, slow growth? Is it about foundational economy sectors? Is it about, you know, what is it? And then you set out what you're trying to deliver, how you're going to deliver it, and then we, as central government, respond to that and say, right, so based on what these 10 local industrial strategies are telling us, now we understand what the shape of the national industrial strategy needs to be. And I would say I haven't really seen that rhetoric coming from any central political,
right,
party. But interestingly, I've had both Tory and Labour mayors have that conversation.
Well, what's your thought on that?
Well, I mean, you just described clearly a top-down mechanism and then a bottom-up mechanism. But what you didn't describe was just a bottom-in control mechanism. And actually, I mean, I don't see very much rhetoric from the Conservatives about specifically how local places should spend the stronger towns funding or some of the other devolved funding pots that that are being spent. I mean, some of it is limited to kind of specific types of spending, but it's not setting the priorities in terms of a just transition, for example, in the way the Labour Party is. So it feels to me that the Conservative Party is probably a bit more devolved in its thinking. And I thought it was notable that when they launched the Stronger Towns Fund, it actually all of the media and the kind of engagement effort was about engaging local people directly about what their priorities were. There's a question about how successful that was. It's a question about whether or not that was just a kind of pre-election exercise. But it was all about local people. It wasn't about the local authority. And I think one of the key distinctions between Labour and potentially other parties and the Conservatives on lots of this is actually the vehicle for some of the local change, because I think the Conservative Party does believe in metro mayors and it does believe in city regions as entities. But I think there is an outstanding question about the capability and capacity in some local authorities and the extent to which you can naturally devolve down to those areas without some change in how those authorities spend their money and decide their priorities. And I also think there's a kind of growing interest in kind of sub local authority level governance structures. I mean, I've had conversations about parish councils mm-hmm. in the
Absolutely,
last few months.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had lots of conversations about business improvement districts. Mm-hmm. I think there is a kind of hyper-local aspect to this debate, which we quite often miss when we talk about towns or indeed cities, kind of a higher level, which actually really is about local communities mm-hmm. in the smaller sense. And one of the more interesting debates that I suspect we'll start having over the next few years is actually what is the right size for specific mm-hmm. types of activity? Right, what is the right entity to run X or Y? And you might have a varied menu of options that that set different priorities at different levels, and a much more kind of possibly a more complex, more sophisticated picture of devolution that isn't just about cities, isn't just about towns, but it's actually about a range of different actors within a single place at different levels, all having different responsibilities, but ideally being integrated in how they operate. Mm.
I think that's absolutely right, and that's very close. You know, NEF has done a lot of the pioneering work around what is community-led economic development, what does that mean, what is that approach, and it's all about much, much smaller units than certainly than mayoral or combined authorities, and exactly as you say, parish councils and so on. You know, of course, what that requires is some, that doesn't happen in a vacuum, and there are very, very national parts of the economy, that function on a national level, parts of people's income that are based very much on, you know, what national wage levels are, what national benefits are, and so on, which massively affect how much capacity you then find in any given local area to drive that sort of civic engagement. And this sort of brings me to a point that I think is worth chucking in. So I think there are, and I'm saying this with the caveat that, you know, my whole life is about local and bottom up, but with that caveat, I think there are two arguments that can be made in favour of why some parts of this policy, why it can be useful to have a national level approach. One of them is ideological, basically, and one of them is completely pragmatic. The ideological one is to say that there are some things that should be provided centrally, certain services, you know, NEF will take the view that universal basic services, that, you know, health, education, we would argue transport, and a couple of other things might well also be in there, where you might have a view that some of these services, that there should be a national infrastructure, that there shouldn't be a postcode lottery that is based on wealthier and poor areas, and that there is a role for essentially centralised redistribution through some form of the tax system and distribution of people and so on mm-hmm. around certain services that we agree on, right? Then you sort of say, well, if you're going to do that, you have to have some form of state, and then that has to interact in some way with the local entities. Then there's the kind of pragmatic one, which is to say, regardless of where you stand ideologically, we are at a point in time that we are at, and the reality is as it is. And the reality in the UK is it is massively unequal in certain regions. So if you're going to press the button now on over to local control, over to civic run stuff, you know, people in one part of the country in a certain town will be already vastly further ahead than the starting point than people in another part of the country. So then the question is, do you equalise that somehow? And I know, you know, the Stronger Towns Fund, a lot of the rhetoric was saying, you know, they're picking the 100 most surprised places, that's where the money's going to go. I would suggest that's not probably not enough. It's money, but it's not structural change. If you're going to recognise that it's taken 40 plus years, I mean, actually more than 40 years, right? Because it starts with the industrialisation, then deindustrialisation, over a very long period of time, wealth has accumulated differently, infrastructure has accumulated differently, social capital has accumulated differently, geographically speaking. And so if you are now going to flick a switch and say everything is now bottom up, basically you're condemning some areas to stay poor and other areas to stay rich. So there has got to be some kind of pragmatic something that says, right, we want to lead, we want to have the democratic decision-making power that's coming from local, we want where possible for stuff to be delivered locally. But in my view, you still want to make it possible for your local parish council or for your local community economic development group to say, right, we figured out what we need, we know how it's going to work, we're going to do this bit. National government, please can you pull this lever that we don't have access to? Please can you change this law? Please can you make it easier for us to borrow mm-hmm. in this way or that way? So that's a sort of pragmatic thing. And in a sense, there's no reason why there should be that much difference between left and right on that. But often it's sort of, I think it gets muddled up with an ideological sort of
thing. It's comfortableness, though, with, I suppose, with some degree of variation and difference. Obviously, how much variation and how much difference is rightly the issue to be exploring. But and you don't want extremes, but the degree to which you are, one is comfortable with some degree of variation and difference. I suppose one of my reflections, for example, on some of the devolution thus far is that we've had some devolution to some places and obviously very little to other places. And then there seems to be this sort of inbuilt response from politicians who then say, right, okay, we need to stop the devolution going any further whilst everyone else catches up. And I'm slightly worried about that perspective, not least because the degree of devolution we've had in this country relative to other places is vanishingly small. But also in a sense that, you know, we don't want to constrain, for example, Greater Manchester's capabilities to do more and to, you know, to get better and, you know, hopefully drive prosperity across that bigger area while we're waiting for some of those other places to catch up. So I'm not in any way advocating for a winner takes all, you know, let it all rip, but I'm worried we're kind of constraining the bandwidth. But you can come back on that in a minute, Richard. But Will, what's your thought on that?
I agree with lots of that.
I mean, I think it's a bit of a false choice to say that you can either have a centralised system or one that's entirely local. I mean, the reality is how you get to a more localised sense is you'd set up a permissive regime that would allow local areas to take greater control as they grew their own capacity and capability and as their kind of own intentions became clear and crystallised over time. So, I mean, you can entirely imagine a regime where central government has actually said, here are a set of powers and budgets that we are happy to devolve, potentially subject to some thresholds around capability, in a similar way to has happened with city regions. Come and get them. And then saying to local areas that they have the ability, the opportunity to go and get those powers, to take some of that control from Westminster. Also taking on some of that risk, it has to be said, and then letting that develop over time in the same way as every policy, really. And I mean, even if you devolved everything, different places would take greater opportunity in different at different speeds in different ways. So I personally have always been an advocate of government effectively creating the opportunity for local areas to take greater control of their own destiny, but not necessarily forcing it upon them, because as you say, there are some places which don't necessarily have that capability, don't actually necessarily want to potentially, and it can potentially create some quite perverse incentives on places if you do just devolve down. I mean, that does come with a willingness for there to be a postcode lottery in terms of powers and budgets, and it creates quite a messy picture. I would argue that the reality is that the existing kind of set of governance structures is already pretty messy, and it doesn't matter if we necessarily make it a bit more messy, especially if you're letting 100, 200 different places do different things in order to experiment about what's best.
I mean, basically, I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I was going to use the same words. I think there's a false dichotomy to a certain extent. I think mess is often very good, actually. It's creative, it's innovative, it's entrepreneurial. You know, I think, you know, there may be difference of opinion about what is okay to chuck into that mess and what isn't. So I would say, for example, I'd be totally comfortable with a variance in the degree to which, you know, the balance between SMEs and bigger businesses, or one area is going for one sector and another area is going to the other sectors. They shouldn't all look exactly the same. I would be less comfortable with the idea that it's an okay thing for somebody to get better healthcare one part than another. So there are certain things that sort of feel okay to be in the mass and some do. Sorry?
They already do get better healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. Interest. And I think, yes, this is true. So I think, you know, you want what you're trying to drive towards is that certain things are, that there's a baseline and that certain things belong in that baseline. And that's blended, as you say, with the freedom, the ability to kind of, you know, have locally led innovation in different things. I mean, I think we get a bit stuck sometimes in the UK context because we're so accustomed to how our political system works and to how the political lines divide and geographically how it works. It is useful, I think, to look into how other countries, you know, work. And actually, I've spent some time living in Germany a while ago now. But it's really interesting there because, of course, it's federalised. It's complete in many ways, completely devolved, but very, very planned. So in some ways, you could argue that conceptually, it's much more centralised. There's much more of a central picture of, you know, this is how the economy will look. And this region of the country will do this stuff. The cars were going to be built over here. Down here, you're going to be farmers. You know, very, very directive. Combined with huge amount of power, resources, even taxation powers at federal level. So I think it's useful to remind ourselves that it's not, these things can match up in different ways. And, you know, centralized vision is not the same as centralized money collecting powers, is not the same as, you know, so there's all these different components, and I think it's good to think about those and mix and match them a little bit more than we do, and not get too worried about, oh, this feels like, you know, I'm from a conservative background, so I better go for these ones, but these ones feel more instinctively right, and vice versa. You know, if I'm a left winger, then I mustn't say this. You know, obviously we want to be getting away from that. The other thing, though, and I think we sort of strayed away from this a little bit in this discussion, is kind of, there's the kind of the moral imperative to decentralize. There's the sense that, it, you know, community controlled is good and we want to get towards that. That's one discussion. Then there's another discussion, which is about what economic measures work better and what work worse. And, you know, we started a bit at the beginning about agglomeration. Is that good for towns or bad for towns? Good for people, bad for people? So I think there's a set of questions about what kind of economic development do we want in this country? What kind of economic development do people want? Which is again slightly separate from the question of how do you organise that? You know, how do you organise devolution powers? What we saw, I think, in the last 5 years with the city growth deals followed by devolution deals, so actually the last 10 years, is that although there was a discussion about how much is this led from the centre, how much is this led from the regions, there wasn't really much variation in what the economic strategies look like. You know, and if I look at, you know, before 10 years ago, what the economic strategy even managed to look like, and then 10 years later, what it looks like, there's not a huge variation. It's about, you know, building, you know, going for high growth industries, attracting a skilled workforce, building the housing and infrastructure that supports them, and then to a greater or lesser extent, taxing and spending that wealth to spend on the poorer people. And that, you know, that just doesn't seem, and that's what I think is interesting to tackle. And I think you have more likelihood of getting there if you start small and local, because people have more likelihood of saying, well, what really matters to us is this, and so we develop an economic strategy around that. But even at local authority level, and certainly combined authority level, you're already starting to slip away from what do local people's priorities look like and towards the kind of, we must get more office blocks and then hopefully some of the poorer people will get jobs eventually, maybe as cleaners. That's the thing you have to cut through, and that comes, you know, regardless of where you sat on the political spectrum. That's what I'm really interested in kind of unpicking a little bit, is kind of our approach to kind of the different ways that we might be approaching economic development in cities and in towns.
No, quite. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting one around that. I wouldn't expect to see significant variation between what the bigger metro areas, the bigger conurbations are doing, because in a sense, at that level, they are aggregates of millions of people, literally, and millions of businesses. And when you actually look at that scale, the things that we really need to put into place in order for them to function, you know, better than they currently are, they do tend to be those kind of very fundamental aspects of, you know, the transport system and, you know, and housing that is, you know, reasonably secure and reasonably priced and reasonably accessible, a skills and education system that at least gets people, you know, to the basic requirements of being, you know, being able to take a job that is at minimum wage and hopefully much more beyond than that. The sad thing is, I think, in many of our places, just those fundamentals are absent in some respects. Before we get into the, you know, into the much more sophisticated thinking about, you know, X or Y and Z. So I'm always struck by you know those sort of the concentration on the fundamentals on that, notwithstanding the variations at the side. So I'm slightly coming at it from that point of view. But I just wanted to change tack or come back a little bit and get your thoughts on the politics and the geography, and then, you know, we talk about the economy and how it's shifting around. And how, you know, it's concentrating on the one hand and the implications that has. And, you know, you've both written about the sort of polarizing nature of politics in relation to geography, you know, urban areas, big urban areas, culturally, socially, economically, you look different from and have different perspectives and positions on a range of different issues. I wonder whether you see that as continuing on, is that somewhat inevitable? And what does that mean then for attempts to, you know, to move the country forward en masse if we have more of a polarizing issue? So it's a long rambling kind of reflection. Well, what are your thoughts on that? You know, there's always been a polarizing geography to voting and to electoral representation. Is it becoming more polarizing? Do you think that's the trend? Because it's not here, is it? It's the US. It's France, it's Germany, you know, you see very distinct geographies now depending on who people are voting for.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, political geography is almost becoming as fashionable as economic geography now, which is, I personally think it's quite nice to see, because actually there are lots of the places that we're talking about, if we talk about the kind of rugby league towns that we were talking about, these are places that haven't necessarily had a huge amount of political attention for a long time because they've been very safe political seats.
Yeah.
You can argue the kind of merits of that, but the reality is that if you're returning majorities of 10 to 20,000 every election, generation after generation, there isn't a huge amount of incentive for political parties to visit, to campaign, to listen to you and to potentially give you attention when it comes to legislative or policy change. And you now have many of these towns being visited every weekend by cabinet ministers and shadow cabinet ministers during this election campaign, because they are the bellwether seats, and I think that's a good thing. But I think the interesting thing is the extent to which Labour and the Conservatives are swapping places, actually, politically. I mean, the political geography of Britain is changing drastically over the last three elections. I think we've seen a huge shift away from the Conservatives being broadly a kind of London, southern party, to a party that's much more geographically distributed. We wrote a report earlier this year which talked about the heart of the Conservative Party moving from Kensington to North Yorkshire at the last general election, which I genuinely believe is true. I mean, it really does feel like the centre of gravity of the centre-right has shifted, and with it some of the caricatures of what it means to be a Conservative, actually. I mean, the Conservative Party is now a party of the working class, winning a greater proportion of CCD voters than any time since Margaret Thatcher. It's the party of apprentices, getting many more votes from that kind of education class than Labour last time. Actually, that whole kind of caricature of the Conservatives as the party of the rich, the party of bankers, starts to fall away when you look at the data nowadays. And I suspect that will be kind of exacerbated when we look at the data after the 12th of December. And the same is broadly true of the Labour Party. I mean, the Labour Party, the kind of party of miners and pitmen and kind of proud working class traditions, is kind of disintegrating. The party is now very much a liberal, quite metropolitan party in terms of its seats. It's much younger in terms of its demographic. And all of that has a geographic element. So Labour Party, much more the party of cities now, where previously the Conservative Party certainly was the party of southern cities. Labour Party, much less the party of towns. I think our politics are changing geographically, and that will drive the different priorities of both of the main parties in the next parliament.
Richard, and you know, I suppose the implications of that evolving, changing political geography, how it plays out then for the economic issues that we've just been, you know, we've been talking about.
I mean, I feel like it's really chicken and egg thing. I think part of what we're seeing precisely is a reflection of the economic geography and the kind of, so partly the way that over time economic inequality has shifted around, what that means in terms of place, and certain parts of the country have become deindustrialized, others have kind of risen. I think partly what you're seeing is then the politics catching up with that, and the economic terrain has shifted, and so the political terrain shifts. Partly it's also the nature of the economy. So it's really interesting what you say, you know, what does it mean to be working class now? It doesn't mean working down a mine, but maybe it does mean being an Uber driver. And so, or whatever it is, you know, there's the gig economy. So I think it's interesting, we say, well, there's certain constituencies that historically would have seen themselves as Labour that may not anymore, and then there's others that are the younger, you know, but there's another argument that says, well, they are the new, you know, mining classes. So I feel like we have to understand the economy is shifting, both in terms of kind of the substance of what it means to be existing at different parts of that economy. Geographically, that's shifted. So one might expect, of course, that the political landscape will shift around that. But then the other thing that's happening, as you rightly say, is that the internal kind of ideological discussions within the parties, certainly in Conservative and certainly in Labour, have massively, you know, over the last 5 years, I mean, certainly over the last 10 years, but particularly the last 5 years, you know, even just summed up within the Brexit, you know, you have Leave and Remain equally strongly on both sides in both places. You have local versus top down, again split across both places. You have, you know, in favour of, you know, a business driven thing rather than in favour of, you know, an identity driven thing in both places. You know, I find that it gets very confusing trying to make sense of it in the current sort of Westminster bubble top down political system that we have. And so there's then another dimension which is about first past the post, gives you a really distorted understanding of what's going on. I think you're absolutely right. This stuff has been cooking up for years. It's only just starting to spill out because it's just reaching the threshold where you're not returning your 10,000 majority anymore. But that was creeping. That didn't just happen overnight. You know, for many national commentators, Brexit was a massive shock. I mean, I hate to say I told you so, but I literally had this argument with my husband who works national level, so just before the election, he was saying, it can't go that way, it can't. And I was saying, yes, it will. Yes, you know, I've been on the train to this place, this place, this place. You know, this stuff was there, but it wasn't really visible, yeah. And we're suddenly becoming visible. And I mean, the last thing I'd just say is, just after the last council election, the most recent council elections that we had earlier in May, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. I had an email from a guy that I work with who works in Hartlepool, runs a community centre there. You know, that's what he's done for the last 20 years. He's not a pundit, he's not a talking head. He never gets invited onto Newsnight. And he just sent me this very short email that was just saying, I just want to explain to you exactly what's happened on the council here in the election. Here's how it's shifted. Here's what it was before. Here's how the two different Labour factions are fighting against each other. Here's how the different bits of the Tory party are fighting against each other. Here's where the Brexit party stands. Half of their candidates came from Labour, the other half came from Tories. Here's the number of independents who now have seats, some of whom would identify as right, some of whom would identify as left. Hartlepool Council now, Brexit party leader. And that short email gave me a clearer insight into what was going on than any of the national commentary is giving you. And so I suppose my one piece was to say, if you want to understand what's happening nationally, if you want to understand how left and right is shifting around this kind of economic and political geography, you have to go to the councils, you have to go to the local areas, you have to understand how politics is playing out in place. And actually, it's not as straightforward as, is it swinging to Labour, is it swinging to the Tories? We know this. It's much more messy than that. It's maybe it's swinging in one part from Tory to Brexit, but actually the Brexit candidate, you know, 2 years ago was a Labour candidate. In another part, it's, you know, Fabians and Corbynite Labour faction has split. Somebody standing as an independent now voting with the Tories. It's sort of, it's completely messes with what our kind of Westminster bubble understanding is.
So I suppose bring it or begin to close. But I just suppose in reflection on that, we'll start with you, Will, is to whether, you know, the messiness that we see in national politics now, and obviously plays out in different places, you know, whether that will it enable more of the agenda that we've discussed to happen, or will it actually in the end be more of a inhibitor or a resistant? I know that's a very hard, but in a sense it is partly that chicken and egg, but then one drives the other, and you know, you're never quite sure which way around it is. But I suppose when you think about political geography and its the evolving nature of it, does that give us more hope for the things that we all, you know, want to see happen?
Well, I think, I mean, as Rachel describes, the kind of political volatility has been growing for some time. I think it's only become visible really in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, really since the 2015 general election, which obviously returned a very moderate Conservative coalition majority. And then we had the referendum, and suddenly a load of stuff became visible, which I think has been going on for a long time, but was completely invisible for many in the Westminster bubble until that point. But that volatility, I think, is going to continue. I mean, we had 42% of people switch their vote at the last general election. I suspect it will be higher at this general election. Kind of extraordinary levels of kind of voter volatility, and the parties will have to respond to that in some way, and they will need to come up with lasting solutions. And to my mind, the only real lasting solution to this is devolution, because actually, I mean, obviously the phrase in 2016 was take back control. Lots of the kind of political noise since then has been about kind of restoring some kind of sense of autonomy and control and belonging and place to people's lives. And the only real way you can do that in policy terms is by actually manifestly giving people more control in terms of budgets and powers. So I suspect this agenda is actually pretty ripe for furthering and kind of greater action on behalf of both parties. Actually, I suspect it's the way both parties are going. They might differ in the methods by which they get there, but the end point is probably broadly the same, with local people having much greater control over where they're going.
Rachel, final thoughts from you on that?
Yeah, I think that is right. I think the momentum is pretty unstoppable. Politically, I think the battle has been won broadly across the spectrum, that this is the way it's going, and the speed will differ, but that's the way it's going. The thing that will make or break it for me is how quickly the economy is very centralised and politics is centralised. I feel like we've opened a seal on the centralisation at political level, and there's enough people now pushing that it will go. You've got the metro mayors becoming more powerful, you've got stuff coming up from below. But the economy itself is still so centralised, and it is still so baked into all of the infrastructure that sits underneath that, the investment architecture that's underneath that. I actually think that all of us who believe in that decentralisation need to basically really work together to dismantle, you know, to reconfigure how the economy works. Because otherwise, what you'll get is increasing appetite and increasing frustration by those who are kind of being ostensibly given more powers regionally, finding that, you know, they're turning the tap on and nothing is coming out. And that I worry sometimes about what's going to happen in 5 years' time when more control's been devolved and still the economy isn't really delivering for people. You know, that would be a bad outcome, right? So I think it's about recognizing that there is some intervention that's going to have to be done to kind of change the way the architecture of the whole economy works. Part of that's geographic, and if we can get that right, we've got I think the momentum and the appetite and the realization is there. I don't think we can go back.
My guests today have been Will Tanner and Rachel Lawrence. Thanks very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter, at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.